What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's been called a sea change in the rules of love and sex in the workplace. A new California Supreme Court ruling says that if the boss is having an affair in the office and it's not with you, you may be the victim of sexual discrimination. That puts a sharp new legal frame around an old workplace dynamic. When office politics are pillow talk, lovers may be at a distinct advantage, and now the courts may offer recourse to the disadvantaged. This hour On Point, sexual favoritism in the workplace and in the courts. Joining me now from San Francisco is Scott Graham. He's editor-in-chief of Cal Law and the Recorder, two California legal journals. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell us about the case behind this ruling. What happened?
Well, it's a really interesting case. The warden of Valley State Prison for Women in Chowchilla, California, was accused of having had sexual affairs with his secretary and two other employees of the prison. And those three women have never complained, so far as we know, but two other employees, a correctional officer and her assistant, complained that they were being subjected to a hostile environment by all these affairs, and that they were being passed over for promotion in favor of the women who were having the affairs.
So it's not the old sexual harassment charge. The boss is giving me trouble. There were three women who were apparently consensually having sex with the boss, and it was the other workers who felt unfairly treated.
That's right. That's what the allegations say. And this is definitely a new kind of take on harassment. And when the lower courts looked at it, they said, look, even if the allegations are true, the plaintiffs were not being subjected to sexual advances, and both men and women were being passed over for promotion, so there's no discrimination on account of sex. And the harassment laws flow from the discrimination laws, so they said that, therefore, there's no harassment either. But when the California Supreme Court looked at it last month, they disagreed. They said that while an isolated instance of sexual favoritism may not create liability, if it's sufficiently widespread, then it can give rise to a hostile environment claim. They said the kind of atmosphere that was alleged in this case, and it was really a pretty bizarre atmosphere, that it sends, quote, a demeaning message to female employees that they are viewed by management as sexual playthings, or that the way to get ahead is to sleep with the boss. Mm. And that, the Supreme Court said, is discrimination.
I want to look at the implications of that, but give us a sense of what was going on there, Scott. It's been described as a prison house version of Peyton Place.
Yes.
What were these other employees being confronted with?
Well, the warden and the women he was accused of having the affairs with all worked together at a different prison in Chowchilla. In 1994, the warden was said to be having an affair with his secretary, with an associate warden, and with another employee of the prison. Around that time, the warden is transferred to the Valley State Prison, and before long, the three women he's been sleeping with are also transferred to Valley State. Mm. The plaintiff in the case, her name is Edna Miller, is serving on the interview committee when the secretary applies for a promotion. The committee doesn't choose the secretary, but the warden tells them, make it happen, and she gets the promotion. The secretary then allegedly brags about her power over the warden to the plaintiff mm-hmm. and to other employees. And then later that year, another of the women who's having the affair with the warden is competing against the plaintiff, against Miller, for a promotion to facility captain. And this woman having the affair is also boasting that she will get the job, she says, or she will take the warden down because she knows, quote, every scar on his body.
that is, she knows him intimately.
Yes. And this time, the warden actually serves on the interviewing panel, and the job goes to the woman that's having the affair, even though she's allegedly less qualified than the plaintiff in the case.
Scott, one of the judges on the California High Court called this the workplace from hell, and as you describe it, that's pretty easy to see. But was the California High Court concerned that they would create, that they'd pass down a ruling here that made any kind of office romance a minefield?
Yes, I think there's some indication they're concerned about that, because what they say is they specifically say that an isolated instance of sexual favoritism will not give rise to liability. But they say if it's widespread and pervasive, then it can. And I think the trick is there's going to be a lot of questions over, you know, where is that line between something that's isolated and something that's widespread.
Do you see California employers now scratching their heads and wondering if they have to put restrictions on all kinds of intimacy between employees?
Well, they say they are. One lawyer I talked to the other day, you know, there's an old saying that bad facts make bad law. That's something lawyers say a lot. They mean that an unusual case can give rise to a difficult-to-understand law. And in this case, what the lawyer said was bad facts make vague law, because they felt that this ruling was just vague, that they're saying, well, if it's widespread, then there could be a trial. And they just don't know what widespread means, you know, because I think the more typical case that's going to come up is where you have one individual who's having an affair with one person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear whether if you have that plus perhaps the kind of boasting and bragging and promotion that goes on in this case, does that amount to a widespread case?
But a whole new arena cracked open here by the California High Court. Scott Graham, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Scott Graham, editor-in-chief of Cal Law and the Recorder. He spoke with us from San Francisco. I want to turn to another voice in San Francisco now. Barbara Lawless joins us. She was attorney for Edna Miller in Miller versus Department of Corrections, the case that the California High Court has ruled on. Barbara Lawless, thanks for joining us.
Well, hello. How are you this morning, Tom?
We're great, and we understand that this workplace was described as the workplace from hell. When Barbara or Edna Miller came to you and described what she was putting up with, how did she put it to you? How did she describe it?
Well, she described it quite extensively. She, like most of my clients, she was quite upset. She was distraught. She had been through the workplace from hell, and she suffered the repercussions of it. But I have to disagree with you about the law being new or innovative. If, as you will note in footnote 7 of the Supreme Court decision, much of this case is based on a policy statement that was issued by 1990 by the EEOC, and it was specifically approved by now Justice Clarence Thomas when he was the chairman of that organization. And that policy statement made it very clear that there were federal and, in our case, because we have extended the law to the state, protections to women who suffer the repercussions of either consensual or non-consensual affairs by their bosses and other workers.
But with this ruling, haven't they clarified that in action? I mean, taking it out into the workplace in a way that we haven't quite seen before.
Well, you know, I have to disagree with that.
Really?
Because the Prosco, the reason I took this case when it came into the office without a blink of an eyelash was on the books already in California. We had the Prosco case. And the Prosco case was a case where, I believe it was, a secretary who had worked for many years for a boss, maybe 15 years, and she was a sole employee. He hired a new employee, a woman, commenced to have an affair with the woman, and then had to discharge one of the people in a layoff. So he obviously kept his paramour and discharged the long-term employee, and she sued, claiming sex harassment, favoritism, and discrimination.
So why didn't your client find satisfaction in the lower court? Why did she have to fight it all the way up in California?
That very often happens. Courts are not perfect, as we all know, and they're subject to the whims of localities and local thinking. This court was venued in not in San Francisco or Alameda County, but in Sacramento County, which tends to be a little more conservative, and the judges there tend to be more than conservative, because had they followed the earlier precedent in the Prosco case, that case said that it, since it was an isolated incidence of favoritism, that the plaintiff could not prevail. But that case extensively described the EEOC regulations and left the door open for my case.
It sounded
When it walked in the door, I saw it immediately.
Right, and I mean, it does sound like an extraordinary case where you've got three paramours in one workplace. It must have been your client, Edna Miller, had been working in the system for 19 years, and suddenly she was up against a kind of insurmountable phalanx, it sounds like.
She was traumatized by it. In addition, she had a master's degree. K.G. Brown, who got the job over her, didn't. K.G. Brown, when she first started applying for these jobs, didn't even have management experience, and my client had several years of experience. So you can imagine how horrible and debilitating it was for her to sit in the sidelines and watch two promotions over her by this person.
And was it just perfectly clear that this was a matter of sexual favoritism? Was it just in everyone's face in this workplace?
It really was. As a matter of fact, there was an internal affairs investigation that the system conducted, and the finding of the investigators was that it was a hostile work environment, in those very words.
Do you think we're going to see tighter oversight of workplace relationships with rulings like this coming down the pike, Barbara?
Well, you know what's really interesting to me? I've been doing this for 30 years now, and I have seen that there has been a lot more regulation in the workplace, but it never, never hits the people at the top. And for some reason, I call them the alpha males. The males at the top feel entitled. And they always feel that they can't, you know, these rules are for other people, not for themselves. So they continually get themselves in these same messes. And I think a lot of it has to do with risk-taking and maybe the way they got there.
We're going to dive in and look at a lot of details of this case and what it may mean for the country. Barbara Lawless, attorney for Edna Miller, one of the plaintiffs in Miller versus Department of Corrections, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tom.
We're talking about a new ruling on sexual favoritism in the workplace. The California High Court says colleagues can sue over your affair with the boss. You can join us. What's it like in your workplace? Have you seen it? Have you seen colleagues disadvantaged at work by someone else's intimacy? Have you seen sexual favoritism when the boss has a playmate, a lover, a real love on the staff? Is it time to adjudicate love and its impact in the workplace? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour about a new ruling on sexual favoritism in the workplace. The California High Court saying colleagues can sue over your affair with the boss. You can join the conversation. What's it like at your workplace? And can a boss and a staffer be intimate without diminishing workplace fairness? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Is this turf for the courts? We're joined right now from San Francisco by Jeff Tannenbaum, attorney. He's chair of the Employment and Labor Practices Division at Nixon Peabody, an expert law firm on workplace sexual harassment. Jeff Tannenbaum, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
Great to have you. Barbara Gutek is also with us from Tucson, Arizona, where she's professor of women and leadership at the University of Arizona. She's a professor also at the management of management at the University of Arizona's Business School. Barbara, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Jeff Tannenbaum, you're writing about this as a groundbreaking decision by the California Supreme Court. How do you see what's been broken open here?
The case is new in the sense that we now have employees bringing claims when they themselves have not been a part of the relationship that has perhaps caused them difficulty in the workplace. So it's new in that sense. It is really an extension of pre-existing law in the sense that favoritism in the workplace can be very demeaning and can cause tremendous upset to employees in the workplace. So in that sense, it's really an extension of existing law. But this is really the first time that a court has been so express in allowing this type of claim to proceed.
Barbara Gutek, I'm reading here an essay from David Cadieux and Thomas Kaufman in The Recorder. We talked with the editor-in-chief there, Scott Graham, earlier. And he They say that the statutory tort of sexually hostile work environment now has a new variant, widespread sexual favoritism. They write it will give California employees fresh encouragement to explore the adage that the life unlitigated is not worth living. The result will be a workplace that is more polite and less sexual, if more sterile and less fun. So, I mean, the case in question sounded awful at the prison, but are we putting a lid on a bad dynamic here, or are we bottling up ordinary, natural human relations?
Well, I think if this is handled well, I would say, you know, we're putting a lid on something that deserves to have a lid put on it, because, as you say, the particular work environment that was described truly does sound atrocious. And as long as that's, you know, what the law is aimed at, then I think that's good. I mean, it's from the point of view of a management professor, the work environment that was described is a terrible work environment. I mean, who in heaven's name would want to work there? And unless you were a person who wasn't very competent and the boss wanted to sleep with you, and that didn't bother your morals in any way, shape, or form. So we hope that's a very small group of people. But if we have workplaces that are supposed to be based on promotions and are supposed to be based on merit, and when they're not, that's debilitating and demoralizing for everybody.
Barbara, what's your sense of how common a dynamic this is? It may not be at the extreme of the boss having three paramours on the staff and everyone else frustrated, intimidated, freaked out. We've heard a lot more about sexual harassment. That's been the focus of so much legal attention. But here is what's being described as perhaps consensual. Of course, there's always a power relationship. But the rest of the staff paying the price for a relationship that they're not part of. How widespread a dynamic, a problem, do you understand that to be?
Well, I don't think it's all that widespread, because I do think that people will speak up about it. And I think most workplaces today, well, I shouldn't say most, but certainly a lot of them already have rules in which a person who is a supervisor may not supervise someone that they are married to, dating, having an affair with, whatever. And so that, you know, if there's a rule like that in the workplace, if someone, in fact, wanted, you know, if you have a supervisor who is not married and wants to date someone who works for him or her, then the appropriate thing would be to have that person, you know, report to somebody else. And I know of a number of cases where that's happened. So, on one hand, I don't see that this should necessarily put a damper on relationships in the workplace. What you have to do is separate out being able to reward someone based on your job and your own personal interests. You know, in this case, it would appear that this particular supervisor was in part using his job, using the resources of the, you know, of the state of California, in essence, to further his own sexual interests, and you know, that's not appropriate.
And then favoring his partners over all the others on the staff. Jeff Tenenbaum, you write that employers shouldn't have to be dating police, but that they do have to be aware that even consensual relationships can result in a claim for sex harassment. And you are, as I read you, encouraging something, or at least offering the option of something called love contracts. What's that?
I think of them really as consensual relationship agreements rather than love contracts, but they've become popularly known as love contracts. It relates to something that Barbara was talking about, a policy, for instance, that would prohibit two people engaged in a relationship from supervising one another. It's very difficult for an employer to be the dating police. It's one thing you might very well know, and almost certainly do know, if two of your employees, say a supervisor and an employee, are married. You may not know whether or not they are dating, and you may not know whether or not they are having an affair. And for an employer to have to seek out that information is not only troublesome in the sense that it can be embarrassing, difficult conversation. It can be an invasion of privacy.
So you're suggesting that they should come forward voluntarily, be expected to, and do what?
No. Not suggesting that people come forward voluntarily, but that in a situation where an employer knows that individuals in the workplace are having a relationship, they're dating, perhaps one is supervising the other. I wouldn't agree with Barbara that in every case that relationship, that supervisory relationship, should end. I think two people acting professionally in the workplace can handle that situation. It's not going to always be easy, but it can happen. And so if an employer doesn't want to then have those two people put into different reporting relationships, then another alternative is to have them agree to certain terms for their behavior in the workplace.
And are they sitting with the corporate counsel and negotiating this? Is it that kind of contract?
Generally not. It's very similar to providing an employee with a harassment policy, an anti-harassment policy, and saying, you need to read this, and you have to follow these rules and sign it. This is just a little different. It is a contractual relationship. It's designed so that you involve the parties in the process. They agree to follow the company's harassment policy. They agree not to show favoritism.
While they have their relationship.
That's right. And they agree to act professionally in the workplace so that it's not taking away from the work environment.
Wow. But there you're getting into a kind of very explicit understanding of relationships that are often, maybe well known, but not so clearly defined. Jeff, Barbara, if you'd stand by, I want to begin to welcome our callers in here. Steve is calling from Toronto, Canada. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to confirm what one of the speakers just mentioned, that I would say this is a case of the law finally catching up with what corporate America, or North America, that is, since I'm calling from Canada, has been doing. Because I certainly have worked in a number of firms throughout Canada and the U.S., including in San Francisco, and in all cases, there was a very clear policy that you could not have a relationship with somebody working for you. And in the cases where that did happen, it was up to the manager to make that clear and recuse themselves from any kind of assessment of the person's performance, et cetera.
So a relationship between peers was fine, but not between the boss and someone who reported to him or her.
Exactly. That would have to be eliminated or at least made open when it came to performance reviews and things like that. And alternatives would have to be found. And this in particular, in one of the firms I worked with in San Francisco, it was a very young group of people in general, average ages around, late 20s.
Yeah.
There was a lot more of that going on, but they did absolutely find a way, I would say, in all cases, to prevent the issue or the concern about favoritism happening. I also should point out, in fact, some firms have gone even further. When you look at what Boeing did with Stonecipher and firing him when it was discovered he had an affair with somebody that didn't even work directly for him,
right?
Some firms are taking a pretty hard line when it comes to this kind of behavior.
Steve, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Barbara Gutek, how about it? How widespread are these understandings, these expectations about who may date whom in a workplace? And do we have? We saw the Stonecipher incident at the head of Boeing out on his ear by the board after this affair came forward. Are the strings being drawn very tight in some quarters these days?
I think in some quarters they are. And I think in most large organizations, there is some kind of understanding, just as the caller described, that it's inappropriate to be evaluating someone that you are having a sexual relationship with, and that applies if you're married or you're not married to the person. And so I didn't mean to imply necessarily that the relationship would end, but either the person needs to be moved or have somebody else do that evaluation, or else the relationship ends. So, I mean, there's a variety of options, and often they're not all that pleasant to the people involved. But still, they make good sense for the larger unit.
A business perspective and a fairness perspective. Let's take another call. Jane is calling from Boston. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a personal experience that I want to sort of tell you guys. I worked for a big corporate America company for a couple of years, and when I was hired, I was one of 30 people to do a certain position. The boss, or the VP of our office, he had a actual brother working for him, and he was actually a mid-level manager. During this time, one of my colleagues on my level, she began a relationship with this mid-level manager.
Mm.
And throughout this period, you know, we noticed that there were some things, like there would be promotions and certain people would get, basically, they would get elevated or they would know of these promotions before anybody else knew of them. So what was weird was that I feel like it was sort of like an insider trading within the workplace
right,
itself.
Right.
Because they had their own, I mean, they, if you are part of that clique, if you went with them and did the things and dated within that crowd, and eventually these two actually got married, and she actually became the assistant to the VP.
So, Jane, let me ask you, do you think it's possible to have that relationship in the office and the intimacy and the kind of awareness that, that others may not have and still have fairness? Or is it just impossible to keep, you know, favoritism out of a situation where you've got that kind of relationship right next to people who have no relationship?
I don't think it is. And that's my whole point. Sometimes there would be, you know, offices where I just don't understand. A lot of people would actually, you know, if you work in a, you know, when you're in your 20s and you're working
yeah.
in the office environment, people go have drinks. And a lot of times things happen after that drinks. And, you know, it's just one of those weird situations that next day in the office, you're not sure who's your friend anymore, who's done what with who, who's gotten ahead. And it's just work, though. You know what I mean? So it's so weird.
Yeah, when you try and put the two together, you've got a pretty complex dynamic. Jane, thank you for your call. Jeff Tannenbaum, how about it? The implications, this kind of knock-on effect, are so subtle and pervasive that once you get that relationship, if you really want to get the courts looking very closely at issues of fairness, how are you possibly going to disentangle all the lines that get established?
It's very difficult. It's relationships themselves can be difficult, and when you add them to the work environment and the various reporting lines of communication, it can be a very difficult situation. And we have to be cognizant not only of favoritism, but simply the appearance of favoritism, which in part sounds like what the last caller was talking about. Whether or not it was actually occurring or not, it certainly appeared to her to be favoritism, and that's a problem. And it's a problem not only for employees, but a problem for employers. And, of course, to jump back to an issue that was raised before,
yeah.
not only from the employee standpoint, but from an employer's standpoint, they're not interested in rewarding affairs. They're interested in rewarding merit. So it's a question of how you get there. The difficulty in regulating this is that you don't always know from an employer's perspective about the relationship, so you can't always necessarily separate the individuals. And again, some people engaged in relationships in the workplace handle them very well and very professionally.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined right now from Irvine, California, by Lisa Barron, Professor of Organization and Strategy at the University of California at Irvine. Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the air.
So here we are. Networks get established through relationships. Relationships are part of human nature. Is this court ruling in California going to change the way employers and employees have to look at how they relate to one another?
Well, I think that the issue of the public sphere and the private sphere has been around with us for a long time, and the notion has been that you kind of keep your private self at home and take your public self to work.
But we're living at work for so many hours a day, so many hours a week these days. How do you avoid being, you know, personal there?
Right. In fact, that isn't what's really happening. And I think this kind of case really brings that to the fore. I think some of the problems involved in this are maybe a little more subtle than what we've been talking about, although there's some clearly some obvious ones.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to favoritism, what you have going on, which I think the last caller alluded to, is the issue of access. So just because you're more intimate with this person, you're around them more, they're going to tell you things more freely than they would other people because you've become a confidant, you're going to learn things about the inner workings of the organization. So, you know, we used to talk about women not having access to the power hierarchy because they weren't on the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing those conversations about what new job openings are going up, what promotions are available, what training's available, how to work it with the boss, and that kind of thing. So what you're having here is almost a kind of ironic reversal of that people who are in these intimate relationships with people higher up have this access, and that provides a subtle kind of leg up, if you will.
And now the California court's saying very clearly, if it comes to widespread sexual favoritism resulting, the courts may get involved. They may offer recourse. Lisa Barron, Barbara Gutek, Jeff Tannenbaum, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about a new ruling on sexual favoritism in the workplace out of California. What do you think? Are there relationships at your office that are skewed by sex? And when the courts get involved, do we risk shutting down a common path to real romance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new ruling on sexual favoritism in the workplace. The California High Court says colleagues can sue over your affair with the boss. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is it just common sense not to get involved at the office? Or is this where you spend your time and find your love these days? We're 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined this morning from Nixon Peabody Law Firm in San Francisco by Jeff Tannenbaum, from the University of Arizona by Barbara Gutek, and from University of California at Irvine by Lisa Barron. Lisa, I just wanted to ask you, I know we've just got you for another minute here. I mean, people do spend a lot of time at the office these days. There's a certain kind of formality that's left many workplaces, and it's been encouraged to have less hierarchy, a less pyramidal structure. Is it possible to have all this at once, a kind of fuller, more humane, rich presence of oneself at the office, and yet avoid romantic entanglements that get us into the whole serious area of fairness?
Well, I think you're raising a very good point that people are identifying with work a lot, spending a lot of time there, and that's where they meet people. I think the issue of the hierarchy is very important. So I think that having a relationship with a peer or someone in a different department who doesn't have management responsibility over you versus having a relationship with someone who does have management responsibility over you is very important, because that's when the favoritism can really make things potentially unfair, and the power difference really can create problems in the work environment.
Which means putting up a kind of gate to that kind of relationship. Of course, that's not always easy to do. Lisa Barron, thank you for being with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Lisa Barron from the University of California at Irvine. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Tracy is calling from Boston. Hi, Tracy. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment that does draw from personal experience. I imagine you might get a lot of that this morning.
Let's hear it.
But I think one of the things that the conversation has been missing is kind of letting the senior managers off the hook here in terms of their responsibilities. And I, in particular, was in a situation where my boss of 8 years had been involved, had basically gotten very directly involved in hiring someone that I was hiring under me,
mm-hmm.
and then proceeded to initiate an affair with this person. And I think that's a good example of a situation where there was a person who, entire group of people who were being directly affected by this relationship, and it very much damaged the morale of the group.
Was it clear to everyone in the workplace, Tracy, what was going on here?
Yeah, it was pretty much, there was a lot of sightings and overhearings that as things happen in workplaces.
So we're hearing that bosses just shouldn't do this. They shouldn't have relationships with people who are beneath them or reporting to them. And the courts are saying here, if there's favoritism displayed, that's not on anymore. Suit can be drawn. Do you think that bosses around the country, bosses that you're familiar with, Tracy, are going to hear that kind of thing? Are they going to say, uh-oh, no, can't go there?
I don't know. know if they're going to hear it, but I think that fundamentally, if you're being paid a good sum of money and it's your responsibility and your charter to effectively manage a group, and you make the choice to interfere with someone in that group, fundamentally, there is very unusual that there wouldn't be an impact on that group of people. There are people who, whether or not it's real favoritism or not, there's
yep.
all kinds of perceptions and discussions that happen, and that fundamentally can break down the functioning. And that's a fundamental, to me, abdication of the management responsibility of that person.
And you've seen morale suffer directly, and we hear it. I want to move to some more callers. Tracy, thanks for yours. Gopal is calling from Davenport, Iowa. Gopal, you're on the air. Hello, Gopal, my friend. Are you there? Hello. Sounds as though we may have lost the call from Davenport. Let's turn to Lompoc, California, where Jasper is calling. Hi, Jasper. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm not sure that I can speak as eloquently as the last person because I'm so pissed off that somebody who's in upper management, who's been married to me for 15 years, and I was at the same company, had an affair with a CFO. I got fired. They divorced me. I have a wrongful termination suit, but the courts here and my lawyers, unless I was black, they wouldn't do anything about it. I need to have other, you know, unless I was a minority.
So you're still not feeling protected, even though you've got this new ruling there, Jasper?
Well, no, it's like it doesn't apply to me because it's too personal and nobody knows about it. Nobody wants to do anything because it's too... It's just easier to get rid of me and shut me up, stop my unemployment, you know, try and take my house, just try and make me go away because these two VPs, they want to keep them.
And you're on the losing side of that equation. Barbara Gutek, I mean, speak to this. I mean, the subtlety, the nuance of when these relationships get going, it can be so minute and then end up with a big impact for someone like Jasper. But how far into this, I wonder, can the courts wade and be effective?
Well, since I'm not a lawyer, I don't want to speak too much about the courts, but I think that, you know what, one of the things that this caller has made a point that I think is an important point, it's often, a lot has to do with who the organization wants to keep. And so I think there are cases where, you know, people get terminated because they're involved with the subordinate. And sometimes those are cases where the company wasn't real happy with that manager anyway. You know, so now they have, you know, they have a real legitimate reason for doing, you know, for doing what they would like to do anyway. When they really value the person, and you know, there have been rumors about, you know, various people who are very high up in organizations that somehow, you know, the law doesn't apply to them, and that was something that was discussed earlier. And I do think that there are cases where, you know, companies are extremely reluctant to let go of someone who they, if they think this particular person, or maybe in this case a couple or two people, are having a positive effect on the bottom line, they're, regardless of what they're doing, they're going to be reluctant to let them go. And then, you know, somebody who can be completely innocent can end up getting hurt. Now, I don't know what, you know, what the law can do in a situation like that, but I do think that organizations often act and in the interest of themselves. You know, who are the people we want to keep in this place, and who are the people we can let go without feeling that we're doing ourselves any damage.
Let's get one more call in. Eric is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Eric, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment was, I think this is something a little bit more pervasive than just the romantic aspect that people have been talking about. As I saw on your screener, I was in a situation not long ago where there was a boss in my office that, you know, had one of his best friends working for him. They'd go on hunting trips and have lunch together every day, and this person received bonuses and promotions. But really wasn't doing anything that was above and beyond what the rest of the people in the office were doing.
So never mind making whoopee and falling in love, just friendships are always going to be there.
Right. So, I mean, it really comes to a point of how much information does an employer actually want? Is this a casual relationship, a sexual relationship, romance? I mean, I think that's a bit more vetting than a lot of employers will want to do.
Just more than they can deal with sometimes. And yet, you, as another employee, stand there watching and wondering. Eric, thanks for your call. Jeff Tanenbaum, I guess the same question goes to you. Some new territory cracked open here, as you say, in the California case. How deeply into the texture of relationships in the workplace do you expect the court will ultimately find itself?
One hopes that they don't go too far. It's an extremely difficult and complex subject, and the last caller pointed out a number of the issues that come into play here. We've been talking about the issue of relationships in the workplace and how that can create either favoritism or the appearance of favoritism. But what do we mean by a relationship? Are we just talking about sexual relationships? The last caller mentioned a situation where two individuals were best friends. That's more likely that those two people would talk on a number of occasions, and the issues that Lisa had raised earlier with regard to access and availability of information in a non-sexual relationship, the individuals involved are more likely to have more information. So do you really want the courts digging that deep? Do you really want employers digging that deep? If you try to have a policy that says a manager shouldn't be dating a subordinate, and we've talked about the terrible problems that can arise, but at what point do you start to regulate that? Is it at the going out to dinner stage for the first time? Is it a first date? How do you know it's a date rather than going out to dinner? Is there some sort of, you know, when she brings me flowers, test to start regulating? When do you do that? Is it a second date? Is it when they start having sexual relations? And can you imagine an employer saying, well, how many dates did you have? And at what point did you begin sexual relations?
We've just got half a minute, Jeff. Has the California case moved that line? Has it moved the view of the court deeper into relationships like that?
It certainly has moved the courts into relationships, but it's done it in a case that is quite extreme on the facts. It's an awfully juicy case, and hopefully further decisions will refine the court's ruling, and that the courts won't go too far into this area. All of that being said, beyond just the question of law, people need to behave professionally in the workplace. That's really going to be the best defense and the best solution to all of these
and
issues.
A big heads up from California. Jeff Tanenbaum in San Francisco at Nixon Peabody, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Barbara Gutek at the University of Arizona, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listener, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, celebrating the 60th anniversary of World War II's most famous kiss. This is On Point. It is perhaps the most famous kiss ever photographed. On August 15th, 1945, the Allies celebrated victory over Japan, marking the end of World War II. Over 750,000 Americans gathered to celebrate in New York's Times Square. One of them, an exuberant sailor named Carl Muscarello, planted a big smooch on a perfect stranger, a very surprised young nurse, 27-year-old Edith Shane. That photograph, taken by Alfred Eisenstadt for Life magazine, is an enduring image of that momentous day. Yesterday, on the 60th anniversary of VJ Day, Edith Shane and Carl Muscarello reenacted the kiss in Times Square. In this radio diary, the now 87-year-old great-grandmother from Santa Monica, California, and the 78-year-old grandfather from Florida look back on the kiss.
I was working, and the radio was on at the end of the war. And so every New Yorker goes to Times Square.
Here's 5 minutes of the latest news brought to you by Johns Manville. Your reporter, Bill Henry.
The Second World War is over. The Japanese have surrendered unconditionally. Aggressive action by our armed forces has already been ordered stopped, and the same order has been issued to the Japanese. I'm drinking rum
and Coca-Cola. And so we took the subway and went there and got off at Times Square. And I didn't walk very far when the sailor grabbed me. And it was a very long kiss. He held it a long time.
My name is Carl Muscarello. I am the sailor in the famous Alfred Eisenstadt photo. And I was 18 years old. And I just got caught up in the excitement. So I kissed Edith and several other women. Then I went back to Brooklyn to my mother's house. I had no idea the picture was taken till about 3 or 4 months later. My mother saw the picture in the magazine and said, "That's my son." And it was easy for her to tell because in the original photo in the magazine, my right hand has a birthmark. And as you can clearly see, there's the birthmark.
Come celebrate the
Celebrate
the anniversary of the end of World War II.
Can you kiss a total stranger? You got to kiss your girlfriend.
Well, it's really up to you.
There's a couple of heavies in here I'd like to grab.
My name is Al Frenney. I'm a photographer born and raised here in New York. I got out of the service in 1957. And I've known Izzy all my life.
Izzy meaning?
Alfred Eisenstadt, the photographer who took the famous photograph. It was, there was four or five frames taken. And it was bing, 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 bing. And it was on the run because it was a very chaotic day. Who would ever think that the photograph would be the photograph that would be the historical photo? In fact, a piece of sculpture.
My name is Mark Herman. I'm 23. I'm from Brooklyn, and I'm a freelance photographer. I'm wearing a World War II Navy uniform, pretty much identical to what the fella in the photograph is wearing. And it is the winter service uniform, of all things. I don't know why he would be wearing that in August, so it is made of dark blue wool, and it is kind of hot. But, hey, they were the greatest generation. They could take it. We can only aspire to be like them.
The original nurse and sailor are coming over at this very moment.
Christine Demas, I'm Phil Maryland.
Okay.
Well, my husband right now is in Iraq, so yeah, it's kind of poignant for me. So yeah, I wish he was coming home, and yeah, I wish he was here because we would definitely be smooching. But he's not, and he won't be back until September of next year. So you really want it to be now our war that we won, that our, when our soldiers come home. It's probably for our boys. It's going to be a long time in the future. You kind of hope that it's going to be, they're going to be a big welcoming home party for them and confetti someday for them.
But I guess no matter what, even if there's no press and no confetti, your husband's going to get a big kiss.
Oh, yeah. And hopefully it's going to be soon, yes.
Got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between.
Okay, so here we go, everyone. Ready? Everybody are puckered up? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Were you actually deployed overseas during the Second World War?
I'm very, very fortunate. The only action I saw was on Broadway and 42nd Street. And if you don't think that's action, think again.
Because everybody was, they were grabbing the women. Who could blame them? They just came off. You know, some of them hadn't seen the ground for all that time. Yes, I was surprised, and I was, you know, and I was very happy that there was a happy sailor there who had been fighting for our country, and I'm glad he was alive and well enough to be kissing.
Boogie, boy,
87-year-old Edith Shane and 78-year-old Carl Muscarello reenacted their famous kiss yesterday, the 60th anniversary of VJ Day in Times Square. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.